You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
You can't handle the truth!
Could you whisper in my ear the things you want to feel? I'll give you anything to feel it coming. Do you wake up on your own? I wonder where you are. Is it before you fall? I wanna wake up where you are. I won't say anything at all. So why don't you try?
9:16. And then I didn't intend to do the news that long, but you know, I will tell you this: the events in Gaza. That's straight up choreography, right? That is Hamas sending people out there to get whacked, and it's their responsibility. The Israelis have every right to defend themselves, every right. And news out of Iraq, interesting. And what's really interesting is the people reporting on it in the United States, they don't have it right. That's what's interesting. If they see solder and their news is dated by about 10 years. So, anywho. It's called On Air Production. Yeah, it's not pretty sometimes. No, actually, I surprised myself. I should have just played the interview, but I wasn't sure if I'd when you interview somebody at the end of it, the post-production piece of it is you got to clip the back end, you got to clip the front end, blah, 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 blah. And I wasn't sure I did that, even though I did it. Yeah. And I didn't want to air the pieces that shouldn't be aired.
Right.
You don't want to hear that. I don't want you to hear that, because I might be talking shit about somebody. Exactly. So, all right. Without any further ado, just an incredible story. Because if there's a guy who I've had on this program that would have had every right to not be what he became, it is Butch Neal. From Hull, Massachusetts. And I would encourage you, look up where Hull, Massachusetts is. Okay? It is a tiny town. And if you click on a map, you have the city of Boston. And if you go south out of Boston, right, down 93, then you'll have to take 3A, Highway 3A, that takes you through Quincy, Massachusetts, again, south of Boston along the coast, and then you swing east out towards Cohasset. You get to a peninsula. And you go all the way to the end of the peninsula, across a small, you go across a small kind of, you know, stretch of road. It's very thin, and you come to the peninsula of Hull, Massachusetts, and it sits across Boston Harbor, and it takes between 45 minutes and an hour to get there from Boston, or I think 20 minutes by ferry. He's from there. Father passed away when he was 14, and all the things that add up against somebody that provide venues for you to get into trouble. He doesn't. He goes to work as a garbage man, supporting his mom and sisters, helping to support them. And I believe that his mom would have been entitled to what's known as a widow's pension. Which is, I think, the Social Security Administration steps in. Anyway, so Here's Butch Neal. His book is entitled What's Now, Lieutenant? And he's an interesting guy. A little bit more official music today, and rejoining us here on All Marine Radio is the former Assistant Commandant of the Marine Corps, retired Marine General Butch Neal. So, sir, first of all, on behalf of a lot of people, thanks for coming back, and I'm going to talk about your book today, but thank you very much for doing this.
All right. Really enjoyed the last go-around. Look forward to your questions, and hopefully I can answer them.
All right. Well, if you can't, nobody can. The first of all, why write the book?
Well, actually, in the book, I kind of said why I did. My three kids kind of urged me to put down in paper what transpired over the 35 years I was in the Marine Corps, and significantly, the Christmas after I retired, two of the three gave me a book called Legacy, a step-by-step guide to writing personal history. They both gave it to me, not knowing the other one was going to give it to me. And so that was the first reason. The second was probably to recognize those Marines in the battle, what some folks have called Battle of Gatlin's Corner, in Vietnam in March 30, 1961, 1967. And then the third, as I was writing it, I saw that there was a lot of kind of good leadership. They weren't italicized or bold-faced or anything, but they were a lot of leadership lessons learned over 35 years that I thought were worth sharing with other folks. And so those three reasons are really why I sat down and wrote the book.
You have lived an incredible life. Do you ever look around and say, you know, Neil, how you pulled this off and fooled everybody, I have no idea, but you're a long way from Hull, Mass. Out there, across the harbor from Boston, and certainly a long way from being a trash man. Do you ever look back on your life, sir, and think, wow, what a run?
Yeah, actually, I do. As you read the book, as folks who do have the opportunity to read the book, they find out that that Hull is weaved throughout the book. In fact, I have a house there. I'll be there over Memorial Day weekend. The Marines that were with that I had the honor to serve with in that battle, they'll be there for a reunion we're going to have on 29, 30, and 31 May. So, I attribute any successes I've enjoyed leading up to the Marine Corps and developing just strong character as a result of the folks that I had the good opportunity to grow up around and with in Hull, Mass.
You know, this Memorial Day out here at Camp San Mateo at Camp Pendleton, the Vietnam veterans of the 5th Marine Regiment are going to erect, I don't know if you've seen a picture of it, but if not, I'll send you one, a Vietnam memorial to Marines and sailors who died fighting under the regimental color of the 5th Marine Regiment. Those Marines, and the term Semper Fidelis, what does Semper Fidelis mean, always faithful? What is that, and how does that change as you get out of the Marine Corps, as you retire, as we all age? But they raised over $400,000 to build this thing.
Wow.
And it's absolutely beautiful. And I just, you know, you going back and being with your friends from, with the India Company, 39 that you were with on in 1967, for all Marines, these are great examples of what it is, what Semper Fidelis, you know, means in life. I think very, very cool things as, but $400,000, that's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. Just a story from the Boston area. As I mentioned to you before we went on talking about the book, I'm going to be on the USS Constitution on Friday of this week to participate in a ceremony that is recognizing Vietnam veterans. The governor will be there, the mayor and other politicians, and we'll give out the Vietnam pin that DOD has struck. And I'm going to talk to them about just about 4 miles away from where the Constitution is buried, is a Vietnam memorial in South Boston. And that was built in 1981, September 13th, actually, 1981, actually 1 year ahead of when the Vietnam memorial was built in Washington, D.C. And so the folks from Southie, there's 25 names on that memorial, and every year the Marine Corps shows up and they have a ceremony on the 13th of September. So, you know, some people never did forget that. That memorial in Southie was built by six Marines get out of high school, and they went to, they all signed up for the Marine Corps. Three of them died in Vietnam. Three made it back. Those three that made it back, they raised the money and they built the monument. It's a spectacular monument up in M Street Park in Southie.
You know, I want to say that John Kelly one time was telling me about that monument, and he said, "Mac, you got to go see it." And for whatever reason, I cannot get away from people from Massachusetts in the Marine Corps. Whether it's Kelly or Dunford or Sergeant Major Bell, it just seems like they're everywhere. Why is that a fact? Why is the Marine Corps, does it have a strong influence in Boston? Why, and
yeah,
if so, why?
I think it's that, a lot of those names, you know, Sheehan, Kelly, Dunford, it's, I don't know if it's a Jesuit or Catholic upbringing. You know, a lot of the Irish neighborhoods up there were big contributors to the Marine Corps in all of the different wars. And I don't know, there's just a heritage up there that keeps the Marine Corps alive. Every November we have what they call a Semper Fi luncheon, and no less than 1,500 to 2,000 Marines show up there. And it's usually a 4-star as the guest of honor. I've been the guest of honor. All of the commandants have been the best of honor. Joe Dunford was the guest of honor this past year. Every year they hold a Medal of Honor get together up there. Barney Barnum usually leads the group. So it's a great Marine Corps town. There's no doubt about it.
Barnum, you already guys. Do you guys stick together? Do you guys have your own little club inside of the club?
No, Barney's a good friend, has been forever, but he's a good man. And, that Semper Fi luncheon, Tommy Lyons, who's really Mr. Marine in the Boston area, he's responsible for building that. He and two other friends are responsible for building that monument in 1981. So you can just see they were just way ahead of the curve as far as making sure no one forgot.
I want to ask you about different episodes in the book, and I'll tee them up and you hit them. The significance of being a trash man. You were essentially a sanitation worker, garbage man, whatever you want to call it, you call it trash man. What did you take out of that experience? There's a lot of people today that would read that and say, he did what? Yeah. What was the significance of that in your life?
Well, the significance was a couple things. One, that a former friend of my dad died when I was 14, so we weren't really well off. In those days, they couldn't afford insurance, so we didn't have insurance. So, we were lower middle class, probably even lower than that, but that didn't matter. But, I think the significance of that job, this friend of my dad, he kept that job open for me so that when and if any time I was free, I was able to go work and make some money to help the home front and also to help myself. And I was a commuter. I went to a commuter school, commuted 30 miles each way every day. So school was a means to an end. Fortunately, Northeastern University was a great school for me. Although it's a 5-year school, or at least I took the 5-year program where it's called cooperative education. 1 year is a full year like any traditional college, and then the last four, they break it up into semesters. One semester you're out working in some job related to what you're getting a degree in, and then the next semester you're in school, and you do that for 4 years, and then you get, you graduate with a degree. So, I guess the trash man really was just the emphasis on hard work, and it never hurt anybody. And there's nothing you can't do if you don't put your nose to the grindstone and do it.
Do you still talk to young people today? Because you were raised different. I was raised different. I went to Catholic schools, and when life got difficult in my life, nobody asked me, how does that make you feel? Right? My feelings were not at the top of the list, but today, that's the first thing I think the kids get asked. How did that make you feel? You know, and I don't think you grew up like that. Do we owe kids a little bit more toughness in their life? How do you square that up?
That's a good question, which I'm not really sure if I know the answer to it. Sometimes nowadays it seems like the youngsters, and I don't make a blanket indictment, but they kind of look for the easy way out when they're faced with either situations or circumstances that call for perhaps sucking it up a little bit and just moving on. You know, I could have gotten into a lot of trouble after my dad died because I started to get a little bit wild. But there were people in the town that basically sort of grabbed me by the shoulders and said, "Hey, you know, you've got the possibility of a good future. You know, you just got to, you know, you got to get yourself straightened out because the only one you're going to hurt is yourself plus your mother, and you're going to disappoint a lot of people because they see there's great potential in it." So those are the type of people that I was fortunate enough to run into as I went along the journey that called life. And I owe people a great deal of thanks and admiration for them sticking with me.
I'm going to skip over your Vietnam service because we talked about that at length. You came back and you head up to Boston, and in the course of your duties up there, you wound up being a casualty assistance officer. Now, I want to ask you about that. What was that like? Because that is a duty that I know brave men who want no part of that because they'll tell you flat out that's too hard. I don't want to go there. And I think last time you were on, we talked about, you know, I mentioned Jarvis Lynch's brother, Lieutenant Colonel Chaz Lynch, and he talking about he did over 100 and then asked to go back to Vietnam because that was the only place he could go, and he said, I'll be happy to. Casualty assistant notifications. What was that experience like for you?
That was tough. There's no doubt about it. It was one of those secondary duties. You know, I was the guard officer for the Marine Barracks in Boston, and so I was there 68, 69, and there was a lot of casualties there. That was during Tet, and
right.
A lot of Irish Marines, or not just Irish, but Bostonian Marines, were either wounded or killed. And making those calls, I used to have a chaplain go with me if possible, but making those calls was really tough duty. There's no way, shape around it. You never know what's going to happen when they see you at the door in your blue uniform, and they know damn well why you're there. You either tell them that your son or daughter has been wounded, or your son and daughter has been captured, or son and daughter is missing, or son and daughter has been killed. And fortunately, most of the folks that I made the casualty calls to were understanding, and the chaplain obviously helped a lot by being there. So between the two of us, we could kind of, I don't want to say do damage control, but we could mitigate the impact of someone finding out that their son or daughter has been killed.
Is there something that you took away from that experience?
Oh, maybe an inner strength. I think one of the advantages, if there is such a thing, from my having been in combat in Vietnam before I became a casualty assistance officer, maybe that helped a little bit because I understood, you know, what was going through their mind, and I was able to, in some way, shape, or form, because the information about how it happened was always sketchy at best.
Right.
And so I could kind of walk them through, you know, as a result of my experience in combat and having people killed and wounded during my first tour, I think that helped a lot. And I gained, you know, confidence in my ability to deal with people and to help them through crisis situation.
You go back to Vietnam as an advisor, and I want to say that the Marines I know that went back at advisors, that's a pretty robust list of Marine officers. Wow. I mean, there's a picture in your book of you and Tom Droughty, who comes on the program on a regular basis. But, you know, those names, Droughty, Zinni, Smith, there's some big-time names on that honor roll. Why did you want to go back as an advisor? And give me a lesson learned out of that.
It probably, the XO of the barracks where I was at was a former advisor, and he talked about it, and I knew if I stayed in, this was kind of a decision-making point, you know, it was about that time where I could either, run out my enlistment and settle in Boston, which was my hometown, which was obviously very attractive. And my wife was from Boston as well, so there was a lot of attractiveness about perhaps just getting out. But then again, that experience, my first tour, and the trust I saw of the people with work that I had the good honor of operating with as a Marine, and then listening to this XO talk about advisor duty, it sounded like this would be something I'd be really interested in and probably be good at. And what complicated the decision was that my wife had just had our first baby, my son Andrew, and so here I was making a decision about going back to Vietnam, leaving a four-month-old son with my wife. That kind of complicated the decision. Fortunately, she supported my decision, and over I went. And then I think going back, if your vet book, which you had, there was some disappointment about not being selected to be an O3, an infantry guy. This assignment that I was going back as an infantry battalion advisor sort of said that somebody up in the Marine Corps believed that I had the experience and the wherewithal to be an infantry advisor to the Vietnamese Marines.
But you don't truly get over the whole infantry chip on your shoulder. The last thing the Marine Corps needs is another guy under 6 foot with a chip on their shoulder, okay? And you don't get over that until you become the division commander of the 2nd Marine Division, yes? That's when you finally get your infantry, the infantry job that you want. Is that true?
I think, the desire to be an infantry officer, it was always there. But I as I got more senior as a major and lieutenant colonel, getting the opportunity to work around the artillery as a battery commander, you know, being a commander, I don't care what MOS, being a commander is what being a Marine is all about. But I always thought that being a commander or a Marine in a combat situation, the best position would be as an infantry officer. I got my taste of that during my first tour as a young lieutenant, and then my second tour as a infantry battalion advisor with the Vietnamese Marines. That again was that was a tough tour because we were alone. Basically, it was me and myself, and that was it. And a radio. And the Vietnamese Marines assigned me what they call the cowboy, which was a young junior enlisted guy, and he was he humped the radio while I humped my living stuff. And it was just, I learned a lot from the Vietnamese because they had been fighting a lot longer than I had. I learned a lot from them, but they also respected the advice and counsel that I gave them. So it was a good team effort and a real learning experience. And as you pointed out, the guys that I got to meet, the other advisors, I mean, they were some of the cream of the crop that were going to lead the Marine Corps in the next 20 years. So it was really it was a learning experience for me, but it also was a great time to build great relationships and professional reputations.
You know, it's funny. I ran into Marty Steele was my battalion commander at 1st Light Armored Vehicle Battalion in 1984 and or 1985. And I remember asking him once later, I said, hey, sir, do you know Colonel Ray Smith? He said, yeah, he was my roommate at the basic school. What? And then Zinni's name comes up. He said, yeah, Zinni and I would. And it's like all of a sudden this web gets kind of woven that you perform your way into. And that there's this fraternity that knows each other as it kind of progresses through the Marine Corps. It's very interesting. Guys that know each other by virtue of operational excellence, I would say. Because you can't talk your way into that club. You perform your way into that club. And a lot of them, Tom Drowdy, we were talking about, your experience as an advisor. Your career then takes kind of a political turn. So it looks like it's kind of the first, you've been an operational Marine. Now somebody sees in you something where we're going to make Neil, he's the guy to go to New Orleans to rescue this Marine Junior ROTC program that's the pet of a very, very high profile, member of Congress. That must have been coming from being a company level officer. That must have been a little bit of a glimpse behind a curtain that in a place that you hadn't heretofore dealt with.
That's for sure. That was interesting. That was what you take away from that is you grow where you're planted. And I was planted down in New Orleans. I came back from Vietnam as an advisor. Was at AWS, had to be a four-year school, and had been the monitor had said I'd be going out to basic school as a tactics instructor, which, you know, was perfect with what I wanted to do, you know, staying in that infantry pipeline, so to speak. And then to get that strange call, you know, almost maybe a month or maybe a month and a half before graduating from Amphibious Warfare School and being told that I was being nominated for this position. And once I found out it was a junior ROTC, I knew little about the junior ROTC program, except that I knew it was all retired officers and staff NCOs were running them. And I said, well, you know, here I am, an active duty captain. I'm going to New Orleans. I'm going to be running a high school, a junior ROTC program. I said, are you serious? And they said, yeah, put on your greens and be up here, and we're taking you over to Capitol Hill. You got to meet somebody. So over I went, got to meet F. Edward Hebert, and, you know, he was the granddaddy of the JROTC program for all of the services, and he was real proud of that. And he was even more proud that the Marine Corps' first JROTC program was in his high school, Jesuit High School in New Orleans. And it was floundering a little bit, and he just didn't want that to happen on his watch. And so I guess he convinced the commandant, which probably wasn't very difficult, that he ought to look into putting an active duty guy down there. And so we packed our trash after we finished AWS and went to New Orleans and had a great 2 years. And when I left there in 2 years, not only did I have a master's degree from Tulane, but I also, we were named the number one JROTC in the country. So, it all worked out well.
Your favorite food from New Orleans?
Oh, crawfish. No doubt about it. Hands down. We had a wonderful time. The faculty were just wonderful people. The Jesuits, they had their first lay principal there, Mike Powers, a wonderful guy. He and his wife actually were the godparents for our second child, my daughter Amy. So we just had a wonderful time with great people, great food, and a great chance to probably influence 200, 300, 400, 500 young men that were students at Jesuit High School.
You then go back to Camp Lejeune, and you take you get the command of a battery. And I want to ask you about it's interesting. I had Barney Barnum on, and who is a legend in the Marine Corps. And I've had him on a few times. The last time he was on here a couple months ago talking about the passing of Wes Fox and shooting artillery for the night for Alpha 19, the night of his action that led to his becoming a recipient of the Medal of Honor. And but Barney is an interesting guy and a little bit like you. I'm not sure if they teach this in Artie school, but he's not afraid to share an opinion, and he's not afraid to tell you when you're wrong. And one of the things that he talked about was the condition of the Marine Corps post Vietnam. You write about it in your book about the discharge program that General Wilson put in.
Oh, yeah, with General Wilson, yeah, the expeditionary. No, you got me confused now. What do you call it?
Expeditious discharge program.
Expeditious. In other words, speeding up the process. Expeditious discharge program. Yeah, General Wilson had taken over as commandant, and the Corps was in disarray. We had drug problems. We had people that didn't want to be Marines and didn't live up to the ethos of being a Marine. There was a lot of going home-itis from some that came that was post-Vietnam. They didn't sign up to be in a peacetime environment. You just had the Marine Corps was in real disarray, and General Wilson, to his credit, said, "I don't care if we go down to two people in the Marine Corps, myself and a sergeant major. We're going to have people that want to be Marines." And so he got the expeditious discharge program initiated, and it made it much easier for us to process individuals that were not living up to what a Marine is supposed to live up to and get them out of the Marine Corps. And I liken it to you opening a window and fresh air coming in. It was so dramatic, and the change was so profound as a result of that program. Now we had Marines that wanted to be Marines, and it was back to being job satisfaction number one.
I'll tell you what, you talk about a decision that took a little bit of courage. You look at that institutionally, But it proves to be, I've had so many people on the program that have pointed to that and said, you know, that helped us turn the corners much quicker than we would have had to endure operations normal and extending those enlistments. Just absolutely miserable. I want to kind of tie this into you become a ground monitor, then you become an aide ironically, the assistant commandant of the Marine Corps. How do you say that last name, Jaskilka?
Jaskilka, yeah, Sam Jaskilka, yeah.
What was it like to be around general officers like that? I mean, these are World War II, Korea, Vietnam guys. I've had General Lynch talk to me about being around General Barrow, and Colonel Barnum talk about the same thing. I want to say with General Walt and other Marines. What was it like, your experience being around those kind of Marines that had come from all that experience?
Oh, it was just another ring in the growth chapter. You know, basically, it was a wonderful experience. I mean, I went down there. I didn't really want to be the aide. Actually, the guy that I succeeded with, Les Parham, he made the general before getting out of the Marine Corps. He was an artillery guy. And I think just the artillery connection, plus he came out of manpower to go down to be the aide, and I think he just thought I'd be a natural fit with General Jaskilka because we sort of had the same temperament, he and I. You know, he was just a wonderful leader and a good man to be around. And like you say, he had World War II and Korean experience. He was a double Silver Star winner, so he'd been around the horn and knew his way. He was really very effective for General Wilson in dealing with Capitol Hill. And so there was a great relationship between those two. And, you know, you're at a level where you get to see paperwork and stuff come across your desk on the way into the old man's office, and basically you kind of see how their decision-making process worked, and you learn something. Really, I learned probably during that time, which was really profound for my development in the years to follow, was that, you know, as young officers, we sort of work in a black and white world. In other words, you're either guilty and not guilty. You're either right or wrong. Well, those guys have to work in a gray world, because there's extenuation and you know, there's unintended consequences if you just operate in black and white. So he kind of taught that to me, and just watching him and General Wilson at work, I saw the wisdom of them making decisions after they discussed things from one end to the other, and then they were always looking at how do we introduce extenuation and mitigation in here. If in fact, rather than Lance Corporal Jones is guilty, run him in for office hours, why don't we go to a second level and say, why was Lance Corporal Jones late? Maybe his wife was sick and they only had one automobile, or, you know, there may be other circumstances that mitigate the offense that he's been charged with. So that was important, and that was something that I tried to convey to all the young officers, both young and not so young, as I came in contact throughout the rest of my career.
I want to ask you a couple things about being an instructor at AWS. One, my time as an instructor at the basic school and the infantry officer course, I thought it was an opportunity for me, first of all, to learn all the stuff that I should have learned the first time I went through that course, but second of all, to really separate myself professionally from my peers, because you got a chance to study whether it was the planning process or tactics and the way we do stuff and what worked and what didn't work, and you got a chance to really immerse yourself in your profession when you became an instructor. I'm curious, your thoughts about being your time as an instructor, and then I've got a couple other things I want to ask about that period of time.
Yeah, that you know, I think as a Marine, particularly as an officer or as a staff NCO, you learn early on that you really are a teacher. You know, you're a trainer, you're a teacher, you're an instructor. So it's a natural fit, and it's an important requirement because throughout your career, you know, you're responsible for teaching, for training, and for mentoring. And I think there's no better place to do that than in the schoolhouse, because you've got a captured audience, so to speak, 200, 250 young captains, impressionable. They're looking at you as a role model. They're learning from you're under a microscope all the time. And so you can impact them as no one else can, except maybe a commanding officer. So it's really it's a great time, because they're there for one reason, to learn more about their profession. And it was right about that time that General Gray was starting to push professional military education and the importance of maneuver warfare and warfighting pamphlets and stuff. All of those things were starting to resonate, because you know, there was a lot of lessons learned, and not so good lessons learned, from Vietnam, and it was time to kind of step back and take a fresh eyes view of how do we do this better. So, you know, being an instructor, both as an instructor there for 3 years, and then later on being the director, those are great opportunities to influence a couple generations of young leaders to be in the Marine Corps.
What was your favorite Civil War battlefield? I'm sure you spent some time on those things. Did you have a favorite one?
I liked probably Gettysburg the best, only because of Chamberlain's charge, you know, it was close proximity. It wasn't that far away. We went to the Manassas battlefields. We went down to Fredericksburg. We basically took advantage of our location, and with the emphasis on maneuver warfare, you know, we created a lot of what now captain, what now lieutenant type situations, where they had to, this is where the enemy is. What would you do versus what really happened in history?
Right. No, I think that's powerful. Gettysburg's my favorite too, and the decision making around, you know, Chamberlain's brigade commander, how he even gets there in the first place, I think is all is all riveting history. Strong Vincent is his name, and the fight they have at Little Round Top, and culminating in Chamberlain on the left flank. The you also made a point in the book about getting irritated at when you were, I think you were, what were you, chief of instruction in your first tour at AWS, getting pissed at people, because for anybody who's never seen you or crossed paths with you, when you get a serious look on your face, there's no doubt in anybody's mind that Colonel General Neil, whoever you're dealing with at the time, he's pretty intense on what he's doing. And then you go back to normal. I when I served with General Mattis, I used to see him do that. And it would leave people scratching their heads like, I thought he was pissed at me, and now he's not. Talk about that, because I think that's a, not everybody develops that gift in terms of being able to be irritated and let people know how you feel, and then also being able to switch gears and then treat them like a teammate again. I think it's an interesting leadership quality.
Yeah, that as I say in the book, if I recall, I really didn't real. I couldn't remember what the incident was, but I know that I was really, I guess for best term, I was disappointed in what they had done or not done. And so this was my dent, about 10 or 15, well, probably 12 or 15, the young captain. So I called them all into our room, our den downstairs and to be a warfare school, and kind of reamed them out chapter and verse, you know, about they disappointed me, their conduct was unbecoming, they weren't acting like professionals that I thought they should. And I guess maybe an hour later, I met some of them in the hallway and stuff like that, and it was as if it had never happened. And I think that kind of shocked them because they thought that I might be holding a grudge or be pissed at them for a week or two, but I had sent the message. I had conveyed it in the strongest terms I could, but at the same time, we had to move on, and if they're professionals, I'm going to treat them like professionals. Believe me, I could have got pissed again if they ever let me down.
And I'm sure they knew that. You went to work for General Crist, or he came to CENTCOM after you had been there. CENTCOM was not the CENTCOM we know today. Back then, you know, the places people wanted to go were the places we had historically wanted to go, right? When that would be, they wanted to go to Europe and they wanted to go to the Pacific. CENTCOM, yeah. You know, it's not the cool place that it is today. Talk about that, you know, I mean, because the Middle East wasn't on our radar so much back then. It was after, you know, in the 70s with OPEC and all that, at least the region anyway. But, you know, most of us didn't have a whole lot about it. But General Crist comes down there, and you learn how to say something that a lot of people struggle with in their life, and that is the phrase, I don't know. But I, you know, I'm sure you followed up, but I will find out, and I'll get right back to you. Talk about that time. I thought that was pretty interesting. You were country before country was cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Basically, the Goldwater-Nichols Act, the reorganization of DOD, and one of the things that happened as a result of that act was that they created these combatant commands, and CENTCOM was one of them. Just as you point out, heretofore, the two commands you wanted to go to if you wanted to do a joint thing was NATO or EUCOM or PACOM, Pacific Command. Obviously, by the DOD Reorganization Act of 1986, the Goldwater-Nichols, it now made it abundantly clear to all the services that joint was in, and that you had to, in order for promotion in certain ranks, you had to have a joint tour. So, where in the old days, just going down to CENTCOM was a great place. It was sunny south down in Florida, Tampa, Florida, a great place to spend your last couple of years in the service and then retire in Florida. Not a bad move. So when I was down there with General Bob Kingston, he was the sink at that time, and then he was replaced by General Crist, who was coming out from the Joint Staff, where he was the I think he was the, I'm not sure what his job was, the joint staff. Anyways, he came down, was promoted to four-star, and he's a tough guy. He didn't suffer fools, was a workaholic, and, you know, you'd be lucky if he had Christmas off. But I learned a lot from him. I learned how to write, and also learned how to, you know, listen when talking to him. And then I think the telling point with my relationship with him was when we were looking at the JSCAP, Joint Strategic Capabilities Plan, and of course everybody said he was the guy that knew it inside and out, and I had gone over it with him previously because it fell under my bailiwick, and he wanted some things changed. Obviously, I wrote the messages and talked over the phone with the joint staff, and the changes were going to be made, but they weren't going to be made immediately just because they were waiting to get all the input in before they put out another document. I was briefing him, and when I said, that change you wanted here, it won't be made until next time around. You know, stop. That's the trouble with you, Neil. You know, you've been an operator too long. You don't understand the joint business. Because my Irish temper took over, and I looked at him, and I just said, I may be, he said, you're naive. That's what really pissed me off. I said, I may be naive, but I don't believe I'm wrong. You know, everybody thought I was on the way out, and
you said that in public. That was in public, right? For other.
Oh yeah, there was a room full of generals and admirals. So they all looked at me and they said, "Neil's toast." And to his credit, he never did tell me. He never apologized for what he said to me. But from that day on, I could have said a red rug was green, and he'd agree with me. So we got along well after that.
Did you find that the I had a similar experience with General Mattis in a staff meeting. I was his staff sec, and he looked down, and I used to keep my notebook in my lap. And so I was sitting there, and I was looking at my notebook. He thought I was asleep. Right, and you can imagine. So after the meeting, right, you know, and this is when Dunford's the chief of staff, Kelly's the assistant division commander, we're in Al Anbar in 2004, blah, 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 blah. And after the meeting, everybody, you know, going their separate way, I stand up, and he looks at me and goes, "Matt, come here." And he said, "Joe, come here." And so we get to the front door of his office, and he looks at me, and he says, "Stay awake in my staff meetings." And I looked at him, and I said, "I was awake, sir." And he said, "I looked down, and you were sleeping." I said, "Sir, I wasn't sleeping." I said, my and with that, I could see Dunford look on his face like, "Oh, no." And I said, "Sir, my notes are in my lap. And if you look down, and my eyes, if you thought they were closed, I was staring at my notes. I don't sleep in your meetings." And he looked at me, and I could feel the back side of my skull melting as he stared right through me. But I, you know what? I think that he did respect that ultimately. He knew I was a hard worker. And he looked at me and he said, All right. But I thought he was gonna explode. But
yeah, that was the same thing with General Crist. Everybody was really walking on eggshells around him, and when I stood up to him, he had fired a lot of colonels, and I think everybody thought I was the next one in line. But I think he respected the fact that I stood up to him, even though I knew he knew this document and he knew the joint staff way better than I did. But the lesson learned from that is, you know, if you're right, stick by your guns. And same as you did when you said, "No, I wasn't asleep." I did the same thing, saying that the joint staff told me they're going to make the change. And so he was shooting the messenger, and he realized it, I think.
Okay, so talk about kind of shifting gears. Talk about with guys like that, and I know General Mattis was this way, and whether it was an ops intel brief, you know, it's like, okay, everybody, he's the smartest guy in the room, okay? Mm-hmm. All right. Actually, Dunford might be, but it'd be a pretty good fight. And Kelly's not more than a half a step behind those two. So when he asks you a question, he pretty much knows the answer. If you don't dance with him. Just look at him and say, "Sir, I don't know. I will find out and get back to you." And you'll go into his little book and then go find out and come back. You said you didn't, and saying that, but a lot of people don't like to say that in public.
No, I learned that. I mean, you just, I mentioned it in the book in a couple places because when I was the briefer for Schwarzkopf, you know, when you're getting these off-the-wall questions from the press, and you're on TV, so, you know, it's not like you're going to, you can disappear into a back room and come out with an answer, right. But the toughest thing is, you know, here you are, I was a one-star at that time, and, you know, you're expected to be all-knowing and everything, and they ask you this damn off-the-wall question. You know, you had to suck it up and say, geez, I don't know the answer to that, but let me get back to you. And then you had to make sure that you wrote down, get back to whatever the reporter's name was, get back to him with the answer. Because then you gained their trust. And once you've gained their trust in that environment in particular, that was that's the golden nugget for success. Because then they trust you that when they hear it coming across the stage from you to them, they know they can take it to the bank.
I want to come back to that. So I just wrote myself a note. You're selected. You were selected and then promoted to Brigadier General. You're promoted by General Gray. And again, it's one of these cool things about the Marine Corps. It's not that big, and it tends to get smaller the longer you stay in. That must have been on a personal note. I mean, he was a major when you were a second lieutenant coming out of that 3rd Marine Division briefing where you felt like they had tried to hang what happened on the 30th and 31st on your CO, and you had defended him. And then after that, there wasn't much discussion. And then this major by the name of Gray set you down and kind of picked your brain about it. What was it like to be promoted by him?
I was there's such a thing as frosting on the cake. I was in his division as a battalion commander. He knew me. I was his director at AWS, you know, carrying his message of maneuver warfare. So he and I, our relationship went back from way back in 67. And obviously he either put me in a little black book or at least had a good memory enough to kind of watch over me. I used to call him my godfather, but, you know, I kind of watch over me. He had his coterie of folks that he had been watching all through his career that, you know, the Zinnies, the Sheehans, the Myatts, he had those guys, and I guess I was one of them that he kind of turned to when the good jobs opened up or he thought that we had the expertise that that he wanted in that particular position. So, yeah, it was wonderful. He invited General Duskilker, who was there with me, so I had the two of them there, and they promoted me, of course. And, yeah, that was special. That was real special. And that relationship has continued to this day.
Do you still stay in touch with General Gray?
Yeah, you know, yeah, I'm going to his 90th birthday party in about 4 weeks.
Wow. I want to ask you about being the director of AWS because that was General Gray. One of the things, and we talked about it in the other interview, but you know, he's kind of a rough, gruff, and tumble guy. But what he doesn't get, I don't think he gets enough credit for, is the intellectual renaissance that he created in the Marine Corps. You were a piece of that, and there was this. I don't know if it was a competing school, but there was this attritionist, two up, one back thing the Marine Corps, you know, was either fighting or saddled with. And then there was this maneuver warfare approach that was, you know, espoused by Bill Lind. And there was just this. So were you there at the basic school when Colonel Zinni, when he had just come from 9th Marines, when he did his PME? Because General Van Riper was there. And it's
no, I wasn't there. No.
Okay, because you were mentioned in it. And one of the funniest things is that Van Riper's sitting there. I think Colonel Ripley might be there, and Bill Linder's sitting somewhat together off to the side. And General Zinni's talking about the PME he did with 9th Marines in Okinawa, and he said, you know, Okinawa is different. We're not encumbered by dependents, you know, so we can have a robust, you know, PME. It starts late in the afternoon. It goes through dinner and drink a beer and then out into Kinville. It's awesome. And he said, and so I used to do battlefields, something leadership thing. And one night I bring in Colonel Van Riper, Colonel Ripley, and I can't remember, Bill Fike, I think was the other one. He says, and then he says this. He says, they called one the Prussian, they called one the philosopher, and one the surfer. And then he looks over at General Van Riper, and he says, don't wax your board, General. And with that, he was so funny. But Zinni made fun of Bill Lind all night because the Marine Corps had this natural, I think, hatred of Bill Lind. Because he was everything we weren't. He was just snarky, we're sarcastic, but he wasn't part of our club. He was incredibly critical of us and dismissive of things that we would do. And there was just this robust hatred. And Zinni combined this kind of making fun of him, but kind of embracing him throughout the whole night. You were a part of that, trying to sell the Marine Corps maneuver warfare when a lot of guys in the Marine Corps were not buying it and didn't like the idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Bill Lynn, of course, I had make presentations a couple times at AWS, as I did John Boyd. Basically, Van Riper and I were sent down to Quantico, me at AWS, he at Command and Staff College, to basically carry the message of General Gray, which was maneuver warfare was something that we were going to study and we were going to embrace, and the FMFM series of pamphlets reinforced that. Bill was, I had a real run-in with him because he just, he was obnoxious, sarcastic. I liken it to, you invite him into your house and for dinner, and just as he's leaving, he says the food was lousy. Same thing would apply. He would come into AWS, and instead of trying to spread the word about maneuver warfare and its benefits and its warfighting outlook, he always was just poking people in the eye. And he created a lot of a cadre of people that completely embraced maneuver warfare, but he could have done it a lot easier and with a lot better results if, in fact, he became an apostle and an advocate rather than a guy that just seemed to love to make fun of people or to ridicule approaches or to, if it wasn't his way, it was the highway. So, yeah, he was perfect for the time. But as I said, I really got pissed at him. I think the last time I had him as a guest speaker, when he just got up there and kind of, was making fun of either Van Riper or about something that was being taught at AWS or Command and Staff College, and I kind of went after him back in my office once the class was over. But I learned a lot from him, and I think he contributed, because of General Gray's influence, he contributed to the embracing of maneuver warfare as the way to do business in the Marine Corps.
The that's just the way the Marine Corps is today. Are you when you see the discussions that will take place, whether it be in the Gazette or in proceedings or in other different public venues, do you smile to yourself knowing you had a little bit of something to do with it? Because, where we are in terms of the way we think about warfare is incredibly different than the way that it was thought about during Vietnam. I know you talk about this towards the end of your book, but I'll ask you about it now. That command and control system, had it been in place that night, or the afternoon of the 30th, might have been completely different. And if this was my intent is to conduct ambushes in the vicinity to interdict movement, the Captain Gettler might not have even got on the radio to say, hey, he would have just done it. Done what he thought was best to achieve the intent. Are you mindful of that as the years have gone by, not putting something better in place so that those things don't happen?
Yeah, I think that was probably one of the pivotal things that caused me to probably stay in, was to try and figure out how we can do things better, wiser, and not let our people become, the beneficiaries of poor leadership, and that in fact we push down that leadership to the lowest level, because the guy that's on the ground where the situation is well understood, if he has a commander's intent in mind, then he doesn't need to go back up to, and say, hey, I'm going to do it this way or that way. He just tells them what he's doing and gets on with it. And I fear sometimes now that somewhat with the new technology that's coming into being, and the use of drones and stuff are going to give us better situational awareness. It's also going to give the senior leadership better situational awareness, and they may start directing traffic again, which could be really frightening and counter to what commander's intent and distributed ops are really all about.
You know what, sir, it's interesting you say that, because my last time in Afghanistan, I was running the Combat Operations Center for 5th Marine Regiment, and we now communicate in chat rooms where you can sit in there as the MEF forward commander, and you can watch a platoon talking to the company. We call it being a voyeur. And then all of a sudden somebody calls down from division that wants to know what Alpha Company's doing, and you say, wait a minute, like, what are you talking about? Well, hey, we saw this, and it's like, hey, you're welcome to watch that for your own situational awareness. Don't ever call us again. They have a commanding officer of not only the company, but the battalion. But if you don't have those kind of people, if I'm the next guy in the food chain and I say, hey, get that goddamn Captain Neil on the phone. What is he doing down there? I mean, you're right. That's potential. You have that kind of visibility into what they're doing, and it can go.
Yeah, that causes me some concern. Actually, I was talking to the commandant about it last week. I went to a dinner, and he and I were sitting at the same table. And he feels like he's got it under control, but it also is, it is something that you have to keep an eye on, because these guys sort of like, we've got GPS, but we better not forget how to use one's at a compass if somebody's got a good weapon system that can knock out our satellites, and all of a sudden you got to rely on a good old lensatic compass to make sure you can get around with a map in your hand. So, yeah, there's technology is a boon, but it also could be a bust if it's not well controlled and well understood, and if we ever fall away from the precepts of maneuver warfare, we could be in a real a mess.
My guest is very graciously is a retired former assistant commandant of the Marine Corps, retired Marine Corps General Butch Neal, and been gracious enough. We're talking about his book. It's available any place you look. It's entitled What Now, Lieutenant? And it's a question that you first hear when you go to the basic school, and I think that he talks about his career, all of his What Now, Lieutenant moments, and in the book, and it's a great read. And first of all, he's an everyday guy, just so you know. He's from Hull, Mass. So look it up. All right, it's not to be confused with Beacon Hill. I will tell you that if you know your Boston geography, and he's a normal human being, and went from being a trash man to the assistant commandant of the Marine Corps. And I want to talk about you being a rock star as a result of Desert Storm. Desert Storm, all of a sudden, CENTCOM, this is now CENTCOM becomes front and center and has stayed that way ever since the early 90s. So talk about you head up to PPNO, and then off you go to war, and then before we kind of talk about the being overseas, you talk about in the book, I thought it interesting, because I say this, You talk about saying goodbye and not knowing if you're ever going to come home. You didn't have that same experience because you were single when you went to to Vietnam, I guess the first time. But you mentioned it specifically then. And, you know, people say, ask, oh, well, what's the scariest part? And I say, and maybe that part spoke to me, I always say saying goodbye to your wife and kids and not knowing if you're going to see them again, not knowing if you're going to smell their dirty hair or feel them hug you again is terrifying. You know, what you do professionally, I think all of us are confident in our ability. We're confident in each other. We're confident in the team we go fight with. But that uncertainty and looking at those that you love is pretty terrifying. I'd be curious. You included it in the book. I'm curious about your thoughts on that.
Well, I think where you're talking about is when we were going to Desert Storm, and it was sort of an open-ended contract, and we didn't know at that time how long. I was deemed in, as they say, basically General Schwarzkopf went to the Joint Staff through Chairman Powell and said, you know, I don't have anybody with ground combat experience in my three shop except myself. And he wanted either an Army or a Marine officer with ground combat experience to be the deputy J3, deputy ops. And General Gray seized upon me right away because obviously I had ground combat experience, and more importantly, I'd spent 3 years down at CENTCOM as a young colonel, brand new colonel. And during those 3 years, two of the years I spent almost exclusively in the region teaching the different militaries over there how to do military planning. And so he wanted to nominate me, and I guess the Army, I'm sure, nominated, but Schwarzkopf picked me, surprisingly, probably not surprisingly given my background, because of those years in CENTCOM. So over I went. I was beamed in and enjoyed a good time with him. But going back to your question, because I was just getting beamed in, my wife drove me over, and my youngest daughter drove me over to where the hell's over, Delaware.
Dover. Dover?
Dover, yeah. Drove me over to Dover, and basically I got on a plane, and I was the only one on the plane because it was carrying ammunition. It was a C-5, too. It was the biggest plane we have in the inventory. And, you know, at that time I didn't know if I'd see my wife or when I would see my wife and kids again, because it was an open-ended contract, and we didn't know what Saddam Hussein had in store for us once the decision was made to either we attack or he attacks or both. So, yeah, it was kind of interesting. It was a sobering thought, but you kind of, as a professional, you know, military guy, I had made choices with my wife years ago, and I left her with a four-month-old son when I went to Vietnam the second time. So she was kind of up for it. I had done a one-year tour at Okinawa with all three kids around the house at that time. So, of course, it was a more secure environment. And I guess it was really the fear of the unknown, what we're getting into as far as what would Desert Shield turn into as Desert Storm, and what would the impact be where we were going to be stationed. So, yeah, it was a sobering time. There's no doubt about it.
Would you seem like you had a from the start had a special kind of rapport based on shared experiences with General Schwarzkopf? Talk about that. And throughout the chapters that you write about Desert Storm, you talk about his leadership capability or his leadership abilities and how he had to exercise those, whether it be with the forces under his command, with other governments that were part of the coalition and their leaders that were part of the coalition, and with the American political figures as well as foreign political leaders. That was no small event that he ran roughshod on. Talk about him and your relationship with him.
We hit it off really well. He had been an advisor as well to the Arvin. Of course, I had been an advisor, so, you know, that was almost right from when I first walked in. It was obvious that he had the Marine Corps had sent my profile to him, so he had all that information of what I had done or not done over the course of, I guess, probably about 25 years at that particular time. So he was very knowledgeable about that, asked me all about it. He was real pleased that I was going to be there because he at the end of the day, he saw the battle was going to be boots on the ground into Kuwait and then ultimately maybe into Iraq if that's what needed to be done in order to liberate Kuwait. So we hit it off really well. He asked me to do a kind of a behind the screen look at the command just to see if in fact it was ready to go to war. And I really didn't want to do that because, you know, being beamed in, number one, you don't know how you're going to be received. But if they find out that you're going around snooping and reporting back to the old man, that doesn't ingratiate you with the other folks in the command. But I did, as he requested, I came back to him and I just said, you know, my only concern is they seem to be as if they're still in Tampa, Florida, that they never left, except they can't go home at night. I'm not sure that they're ready to give you warfighting information from which you can make warfighting decisions. And, you know, he got all excited. God damn it. He's yelling and screaming. He said, that's exactly the way I feel. Fortunately, his chief of staff, Major General Bob Johnson, was already on it and working to correct it. I just confirmed what Johnson had already been working on quietly, I think. Schwarzkopf and I got along really well. I think it was because of our similar backgrounds. He was a perfect guy for the moment, because he had a great way of working with the coalition forces. He knew all of the commanders, his component commanders, of course. He had done one exercise called Internal Look that sort of looked at that type of scenario where they might have to deploy, although I must admit, while I was down at CENTCOM, it was not a deployable headquarters, and I don't think we ever really even thought that it would deploy. If you look at PACOM and UCOM, they're both in their AOR, they're out there located, and of course we were many, many miles away in Tampa, Florida, looking out over the region where our AOR area of responsibility was. So there was a lot of turning and burning, deploying the headquarters over there, getting settled in. Fortunately, the infrastructure in Saudi Arabia was just waiting for people. Maybe that's why it was built. It was just waiting for folks like us to move into. So there was a lot of infrastructure that allowed us to birth the troops that were in the headquarters elements, and there was a lot of plug and play, just getting set up for going to war. So it was a fascinating time working for him. I learned a lot from him, and it was a great relationship.
One of the things that you talk about in the book is kind of a horizontal theme to the book is eyeball to eyeball leadership, and mm-hmm. You have a confrontation with your boss, the J3. Explain how you handle those confrontations, because, you know, I will tell you, I will echo your sentiment. I remember going with the division, we relieved the 82nd Airborne in February of 2004. The guys who came in August, September, if you could imagine coming late to a party and having guys like General Mattis sitting there, it's very intimidating. And I can tell you stories about guys who, you know, the last couple of days that General Mattis was there called in, they were sick in quarters because they couldn't, they were just waiting till he left because it was such an emotional burden for them. So coming in late is, as I would echo it, it's hard. Everybody else knows the names of the cities and all the rest of that, and you're kind of getting spun up, but you were at CENTCOM, so that probably wasn't an issue for you. But for other guys, it is. And all of a sudden, and you're in one of those jobs, and you're supposed to perform and whatnot. But you have, it seems like you have these confrontations, they never stop you. What's the, is there an art to confrontation as you practice it, Butch? How did you, cause it's, you're no stranger to button heads, yet you seem to find a way to do it and that it doesn't become a catastrophic explosion, that you're able to manage it? How do you do that? Is it part eyeball-to-eyeball leadership and people respect that? Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think it probably is eyeball-to-eyeball leadership. It's looking people in the eye and being candid with them, and I think gaining their trust. The incident you talked about, the J3, I think he initially thought that that Schwarzkopf, for some reason he and Schwarzkopf didn't have a great relationship, and I think he sort of felt like he brought me in with the idea of replacing him. And, you know, I had to be real honest with him and just tell him that, hey, I'm not here to replace you, I'm here to help you. Our boss wanted me in here because of my ground combat experience. You're an Air Force guy, you're going to be able to give him all the best advice as far as the utilization of not only Air Force Air, but all of the air components. So, you know, we've got to work together. And I said, you know, if you feel so threatened, then I'll go see the old man and ask to be transferred back to the Marine Corps over on the East Coast. And, you know, that kind of caught him by surprise. And he said, are you threatening me? I said, no, I'm not threatening you. I'm just telling you the truth. I can't work in this type of environment. So, you know, that seemed to calm the water. It's sort of like when I said to General Crist, I may be naive, but I don't believe I'm wrong. You know, just basically laying the cards on the table. I guess the fortunate thing is that in both cases, both Crist and with the J3, it calmed the water. And, you know, we proceeded to do our jobs in a professional way. So, I guess the lesson is that don't be hesitant to stick up if you're right, and don't be hesitant to go forward if, in fact, that's what it requires.
You become, for a lot of people, you become the face of Desert Storm. Gives people some background on how that happened. And then the media now is at 20. It's not like the media of Vietnam where Walter Cronkite came on at 5 o'clock and did, you know, 30 minutes of national news. You know, really it's the first wall-to-wall news in American history. And you're kind of at the forefront of all that. Tell people how that happened. And then how do you manage the 24-hour news cycle, because so much of what they do in search of content to fill up 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, is wrong. I can remember watching them in Iraq thinking, what are they talking about? And the story was this crooked-nosed guy on CNN who was a Brit. You know, the story, under the nose of coalition forces just south of Baghdad, 120 civilian workers were kidnapped today. And we're like, what's going on? Like, that's Colonel Johnson and 24th MU or somebody, I think it was them. Like, get them on the phone and call them up. Like, hey, what's going on? What is that guy talking about? Like, oh, it's a Chamber of Commerce dispute. You know, we fixed the road, and the sheikh owns the road. The other sheikh owns a glass factory. The glass factory added a swing shift. The guy who owns the road wants more money. They said, the glass factory guy says no, so he kidnapped the whole swing shift. But that was the depth of knowledge. And that was you're expected to deal with this and the fallout of this inept force. And it's like, you know, the American people don't have a chance because the reporting's so brutal. But you had the world's first experience with that. How did you deal with that?
Yeah, I always claim that probably Desert Storm, Desert Shield, Desert Storm really gave birth to the CNN and to cable news. Up until that time, I really didn't know too much about CNN. But we found out in a hurry that CNN was going to be, like you said, there 24 hours a day, and most of it live, both from in the region, from back in the state. And no one understood that better than probably Chairman Powell in D.C. And he just basically, he had to really put the pressure on General Schwarzkopf, because General Schwarzkopf and a lot of people like Powell and others, they still had the legacy of the press not treating them well during Vietnam, and you know, turning the tide, making accusations, but in fact maybe they weren't as close to the truth as they might be. So I think there was a General Schwarzkopf initially was reticent about helping the press in any way, shape, or form. Powell was quite the opposite. He learned from his position as chairman that the power of the press and feeding that power was to your advantage. If you had the strategic message, the strategic comms, that was important for you as a warfighter to make sure you controlled the news, not controlled it so much as you provided the stories rather than having them make up the story. So as a result of that, the position of the briefer for the command was critically important. We didn't do very good initially. We put, I think the J3 tried it, then a couple other officers tried it, and they weren't doing well at all, and Powell was getting really mad with the sink. And then we tried the chief of staff, Bob Johnson, Major General Bob Johnson, and I thought he did a good job, but he also had, you know, he had his full-time job of being the chief of staff, and plus he wasn't as up to speed with the current ops as probably I was, because I was the deputy for operations. So he suggested that to Schwarzkopf that he have me, that he and I do it. I do it one day, he do it the next day. And Schwarzkopf initially refused because he thought I was too busy. But then things were just not working out. So I did it once, and it went okay. Next thing I knew, it was he just said I was it. I was going to do it from now on. And Powell was happy with that decision. And basically, it wasn't very difficult for me because, as I said, I knew everything. Maybe that was the most difficult part, was making sure that I didn't in any way put troops or operations at risk as a result of me saying something that could be counterproductive to our efforts. So I had a murder board every day and sat down with him for about an hour. And the public affairs people would be out working the press, trying to figure out what the topical issues were for that particular day. And then they would ask me questions in this murder board. And I would, 9 times out of 10, I knew the answers to the questions. If I didn't know the answer, then they would do the research and hopefully get me the answer before I went live on the international briefings every night, night our time. So, yeah, it was kind of neat. Yeah, my wife said, you don't know, you're everywhere, you know, radio, TV, in the press, on the newspapers and stuff. Because, you know, it was the first time we really had done it to that extreme. We had done a little bit in Vietnam, but nothing like this, where it was a daily briefing. And so, yeah, I was everywhere. I had 2 kids in college. They saw me everywhere. It's kind of a hoot.
What, talk about operational security in a 24/7 environment where the American media seems to have no problem with throwing everything from CAECO calls to operational sightings onto television. Do you have any advice, thoughts? You've seen it in Vietnam. You've seen it in Desert Storm and in Iraq and Afghanistan. And any thoughts on dealing with the media?
I think the only advice I gave it to Vince, I think his name was Fisher, Vince, I can't remember his name. He's a 4-star now in career, I think. But the only advice I said, you know, you have to, your, the weight of your comments are really is gaining the trust of the press. So you have to be truthful. Now, you know, when you don't know the answer, you got to be able to say, I don't know. And when you say, I can't tell you because of operational security, if you've established that relationship as a result of dealing with them face up on a routine basis, I think it works. You're right. They sometimes because of the 24-hour news cycle and trying to be first, they sometimes will report something, and as we all know, first reports are never right. You know, they just it takes a while to sort out the details. So I thought the other day, now it's been about almost a six, maybe even a year, when Dunford, when they had the Niger incident and the four soldiers were killed, and it became a hot topic in this town, in D.C. and around the country when you lose four soldiers. And Dunford, to his credit, you know, right on national TV, he says, "I don't have all the facts right now. We're sorting it out, and I'll get back to you with the facts," which, of course, he eventually did.
Right.
You know, coming from the chairman, that's pretty powerful. And that's the way you earn the trust of the press. In fact, you go right up in front and say, "Hey, we don't know why it occurred. We're going to find out why it occurred. We're going to make sure it doesn't happen again. And I'll get back to you with a chapter and verse." And I think that's the way you deal with them.
I was talking to a friend of mine the other day, Major General Dave Furness, who's about to take over 2nd Marine Division. And I was telling him about our conversation and reading your book. And the highway of death, leading what, northwest out of Baghdad, out of Kuwait City, becomes this incredible footage that talk to us about the impact it has on the operation, because it's pretty interesting. I mean, we've seen stuff like that historically. For instance, the lagoon at Tarawa did not get released until, I want to say, 1946. Now you have footage of what's going on in theater appearing on television, and the world and the world reacts to that.
Yeah, that was initially. Everybody's saying, "Oh, look at it! We're kicking these guys," but they're paying the price for invading a peaceful country. And then after a while, after you keep seeing that, and you keep seeing this the carnage associated with it, it didn't seem like it was a fair fight. And it really concerned. What turned out to be something, oh great, we're winning this battle, turned out to be something that we had to be very sensitive about, because the coalition, we didn't want to break up the coalition with comments that maybe we're piling on, and so, even as bad as Saddam Hussein and the Republican Guard forces were, maybe we got to get this thing off the front page and get this idea of the highway of death off the screen. And so, things just spiral out of control very quickly now as a result of, 24-hour news cycle, and then these trendy phrases like highway of death or something similar to that, that's not going to sell. It may sell newspapers, but it's not going to sell the American public well.
Interesting. A couple more points, and then we'll move to finish up. And sir, I appreciate your time. Very gracious. You come home. Let me ask you about keeping that thing synchronized. So you're an ops guy. You have the Marines pushing up towards Kuwait City. You have the infamous left hook. And you're moving at speeds. The Marines are making better time than anybody thinks. I think, everybody's waiting for the chemical weapons to be fired, and that hasn't happened yet. How did you guys keep that? Was it as simple as keep, sticking to your sync matrix, slowing people down, speeding people up? How did you keep something like that synchronized?
Well, we obviously had a synchronization matrix, as you pointed out, Schwarzkopf had that thing right in front of him in spades and was watching it all the time. And, of course, the success of the Marines with the Tiger Brigade moving so quickly kind of screwed up the execution of the left hook, because Tommy Franks, he was moving slower with 7th Corps, and I'll tell you, Schwarzkopf got on the horn and really in no uncertain terms, said, you got to get moving or this thing's going to get, you know, way out of whack, and we could be setting up the conditions for friendly fire events. And so, yeah, it was technology helped, obviously, because communications were good. We were able to stay in calm with them and keep things moving and trying to make sure that we kept the scheme of maneuver on time and on schedule and being executed at the right pace. But, yeah, it was difficult. And I look, some of the position reports weren't as good as they could have been, but that's just the fog of war.
You and your peer group had fought since probably 19, since you came back from Vietnam, put a date on that for different people, but had fought to keep America from getting in another protracted war like Vietnam. And you must have been pretty, I can't imagine how professionally satisfied you guys were on the backside of Desert Storm, because there was a limited objective. It was well defined. It seemed like the politicians stayed out of the way after they had defined the end state. That must have been professionally a great feeling after 30 years previous to that. You know, the coming out of Vietnam professionally, that you guys had changed the system so much and set the conditions, at least had this public discussions about the way it ought to be done and how it ought to be laid out. Did you reflect on that after it, in that this was done the right way and it's much to the credit of Vietnam veterans that it was?
Yeah, I think there was a sense of satisfaction that the learning curve from 1975 until 1991 obviously was steep. We learned from the lessons of Vietnam, and all of us were, most of all the leadership, at least at the general officer level, were Vietnam veterans. And there was a sense of satisfaction that, in fact, all of that technological enhancements and equipment, the overwhelming force advocated by Chairman Powell, the book, The General's War, basically President Bush kind of let his Secretary of Defense, Cheney, and let his warfighting folks led by Chairman Powell. Thank God for Chairman Powell. He was there. He was the settling influence back here in D.C. Let them kind of, call the shots and fight the battle, and let Schwarzkopf, with a little bit of rudder from Cheney and from Powell, basically let him run the war that he wanted to fight the way he wanted to fight it. So, yeah, it was very satisfying, particularly when it was over. You know, we were... Right. We weren't slapping each other on the back, but we were real happy with how it had been planned and how it had been executed.
When you saw the way that we went to war in Iraq and broadening the war in Afghanistan, did you have, as you watched that, I mean, I think that we've strayed a little bit from that path. I've had General Zinni on, and you know, he's told me, you know, he said, Mac, you know, the frustrating part about Iraq was that everything that's happened was predicted to happen in the war plan. But, you know, we tore the war plan up and we wrote a different one. And
yeah, we got a little bit of home, you know, getting home-itis. And,
right.
You know, it's a wrap. And we forgot about Phase 5, stability operations. And, yeah, that's disappointing because those are things that, heck, I can remember when I was with them. Baghdad Staff Planning Group as a senior mentor for the Marine Corps. And, you know, one of the things we were emphasizing was stability operations. You know, it's not the fun stuff. It's not the fix bayonets and charge ahead or you know, pedal to the metal with your tanks and stuff. It's really the nuts and bolts stuff of getting countries reestablished and getting governments going and getting all of the different outfits and branches and divisions that make up a government to make sure that they can function and meet the needs of the people. We kind of forgot that, and in our haste to fix bayonets and win the offensive part, we forgot about the stability part, and we left too early and kind of left things in a mess.
Well, it's interesting to have, and then to talk about General Newbold, and I'm curious about your thoughts, sir, on when general officers disagree. There's a fair amount of debate on again, I talk about being in Afghanistan. You know, whoever decided that we should expand the ground war in Afghanistan is attempting to create something that's never been created in the history of that nation. And so if Germany and Japan were 60 years events, what is Afghanistan? 160? 160?
Yeah.
Are we prepared to do that? And if we're not prepared to do that, I didn't go to Yale or Harvard, right? I went to a Catholic school that guys with C-plus, B-minuses average in high school could get into here at the University of San Diego. But I'm nobody's dummy. Okay, I can add and subtract, and it's immoral for us to ask young soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines to die and then to walk away. And what do what do we tell their parents? Because again, so at the OPT is I think it's a great idea, but what if it doesn't work? And what about this? Is the American public, is everybody read in on this? Are we going to do this? And I think we've strayed from the lessons of Vietnam, sir. I think it's very disappointing, and we've destabilized the entire Middle East now with the war in Iraq that spread into Syria, and shows now we have Israel staring at Iran. So for a Vietnam veteran who worked so hard to keep the country out of senseless wars, and if we're going to go define it and let us do it, and then to see us, it seems like, drop the ball as an institution and not focus on phase four, and you go to war to win the peace and not get that done, it's not good. And it's not good when the United States is diminished, because with all of our warts, nobody's even close to us in terms of doing good things around the country. So your thoughts on any of that? I know I'm...
No, you're not...
I'm venting.
I don't disagree with you at all. In fact, I agree with 99% of what you said. We haven't... we've fallen off from... We experienced great success with Desert Shield and Desert Storm. Some would argue we should have went to Baghdad, but that's an argument for another day.
Right.
But then the second time we went over there, we basically... went over there, did the job again, and this time we really, by not thinking through how do we help this country recover, talking about Iraq,
right,
how do we help this country? Basically, we left in a hurry and left the situation was worse than when we went over the first time around. So, we've kind of gone astray from thinking through not only the fighting part about it, but the stabilization part about it. We've thought about it. We haven't really come to grips with the other elements of national power, diplomacy, economic, judicial, and not just the war fighting part. So we've still got a ways to go, and the learning curve is still pretty damn steep.
All right, I have two more questions for you.
I'm running out of time.
As I said, I could do this all day. You're a fascinating guy with a fascinating life. CG of the 2nd Marine Division, as you rise up through echelons of command, does it change how you're able to command? Because you can't reach, there's a lot of people that you want to reach, but you can't reach that many in a day or in a month. Is there a difference in terms of style, or is it just your same style? You keep doing it, and you get after it, and you have to animate more subordinates at higher levels. How do you do it?
I don't think it changes that much. I think you relinquish control a little bit by depending. You delegate and you depend on your chief of staff to take care of that paperwork that you'll sign when you get back in the office. But I think the requirement you know, for eyeball level leadership, it's just as demanding as a battery commander, a battalion commander, brigade commander, or a division commander. And a visible presence is mandatory, and so you've got to get out and about. And that's basically what I did as a division commander. I didn't go through the barracks to look for dust balls or broken light bulbs. I went through the barracks as a visible presence to make sure that the troops knew I cared about them. I cared about their living conditions. I cared about the command climate within their respective organizations. And I was down there at the mess hall at 5 o'clock in the morning to make sure that the cooks had the trays all full, so that when they opened up that mess hall at 5 or 5:30, whatever the time may be, and now I guess they call it a dining facility,
right,
that in fact the stuff is hot, it's ready to be dished out, and it met the needs of the young men and women called Marines and sailors. So, you know, I don't think there's a change. Maybe there's a change in perspective. Some guys and gals maybe aren't as comfortable as I was in moving about the squad bays, the barracks, the individual rooms, the rec halls, the gym, or getting out in the morning and just running with an organization, not even telling them I'm going to run, just end up on the tail end of their organization and run with them for whatever their PT was for that particular day, and then getting out in the field and questioning young leaders and young PFCs about, you know, what's going on within that command. Because as you get older, more seasoned and experienced, you get a feeling in your fingertips as to how an organization is. You know what the command climate is without asking anybody. You can just get a sense of it. So I don't think it changes too much. Perspective probably a lot. You know, I was looking at battalions and not so much at platoons when I was a division commander, but even I get down to the lowest level, and you know, that's what kept the, you know, that's where job satisfaction was number one.
All right, I'm going to skip over your time as the assistant commandant. All right, maybe on a different time we'll cover it.
Okay.
Post combat related mental health. You know, I asked you about a map, and you said I've left that apart. How? I mean, what you went through in 1967, that was men's stuff. That was grown-up stuff. That was not little kid stuff. You know, we have a big discussion now. We have a diagnosis for it in terms of post-traumatic stress. We have people medicated for it, and all kinds of things. I'm curious. Your thoughts, did you give advice to guys who have dealt with this and are struggling with it? Do you have thoughts on it?
My thoughts, you know, sometimes I kind of wonder why didn't I have, you know, problems basically with some of the stuff I went through that first tour in particular, maybe even the second tour during the event in Cambodia. But I think one of the advantages I had was that I stayed within the institution. So I was mixing and mingling and leading and being led by people who had similar situations. So I think that kind of mitigated any opportunity for PTSD probably settling in. We've always had PTSD. We've just had different names for it, shell shock,
right,
stuff of that nature. But I think the young men and women that are experiencing that now, the only thing I keep emphasizing is, you know, you got to seek professional help. You can't turn away or try to think that it'll go away with time. If you're experiencing anxiety, suicidal type thoughts, you got to seek professional help, and it's not something that lessens you in the eyes of the Marine Corps. You're a human being first, a Marine second, and we all have you know, strengths and weaknesses, and we have to make sure that we recognize them. And for leaders, it's an imperative that they know the signs, the early warning signs of someone that's got some problems, and taking the time to get that individual the professional help he needs. And we've got to make it abundantly clear to the young men and women that we call Marines that, you know, if they've got problems, if you know, a shaved head and muscles across the body, that's that doesn't make you a good Marine. What makes you a good Marine is being able to help each other and look out for each other and make sure that if someone needs help, make sure he gets that help.
Well said, sir. I mean, I don't think it's anything more than taking care of Marines and us socially and institutionally adjusting to, hey, Neil's at the gym, McNamara's going to mental health, so-and-so's going to pass an ID, and nobody blinking an eye at any one of those, because it's honestly, it's a person that doesn't sit down and talk, that comes back from that stuff, that is probably the one that you ought to be worried about. But, no, I mean, I think your comments are spot on. All right, the lightning round, your favorite musical group is?
The what now?
Your favorite musical group is?
Oh, my God.
Come on, sir. You're in the 60s. Come on. Who, the Grassroots?
My favorite were the Righteous Brothers.
The Righteous Brothers. All right, favorite food?
It remains a Boston hot dog.
Your favorite sports team? It could only be one. It can't be a whole series of them.
It can't be?
No.
The Red Sox Patriots.
Nice. The Bruins just lost, so they're out for a while. And
no, they're out. They didn't live up to expectations.
There you go.
Although the Caps are doing good, so I don't know.
That's pretty amazing. If they could finally break through, that's what I'm pulling for. I'm pulling for Ovechkin's been through enough of his life. Maybe he can do something good. Give us a good book to read, and I'll let you go.
Oh, a good book. I just finished one that's kind of interesting. It's a little squirrely, but it's not bad. It's called what the hell's the name of it? Radical Inclusion. It's by the former chairman of the Joint Staff, Marty Dempsey.
All right, Radical Inclusion. What's it about?
It's leadership. Kind of. It's a leadership book. But his theory is that it's written with him and an academic. The academic is the portion I didn't really like. But anyways, basically, it's about leadership being an inclusive type leadership. And basically, it's an academic treatise on what now, Lieutenant.
That's what I thought you were going to say. Give me a good book to read. I thought you were going to say, "What the hell, Mac? What now, Lieutenant?" That's the book we're talking about. Sir, look, first of all, thank you very much. I will get out of your hair. I hope you don't mind on occasion if I bug you, if we're talking about leadership or maybe foreign affairs or something like that, and maybe come on and give me 30 minutes as opposed to a couple hours. If you don't mind, now that I have your email address, if I bug you every once in a while.
No problem at all, Mac. Honestly, I've enjoyed it. It's kind of good to, chew these grapes over again every now and then. So, yeah, no, it's good. It's
no,
good.
Well, let me tell you. From Hull, Massachusetts, and you should, if you're listening to this, look up where Hull, Massachusetts is, okay? It is a speck. A remarkable life, an honorable life, a life full of making things better that you touch, sir. And the book is a great book. When I first started reading, I said, okay, here's another general book, so what's he have to say? But I think the combination of being an ordinary guy, that comes from an ordinary family and fights uphill for a fair amount of time is it makes for compelling reading, and the way you write it's well done. So my compliments. And sir, again, thank you very much for doing this. Appreciate it.
All right, Mac, you take care, and don't hesitate to contact me if we want to chat again.
Okay, sir. Take care. Thank you.
All right, simplify.
That is Butch Neil, the former assistant commandant of the United States Marine Corps, general type. The book is entitled "What Now, Lieutenant?" It's an awesome read, and as you might imagine, from somebody with that kind of career. Don't touch your dial. More of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network. How about that? Butch Neil, general type, United States Marine Corps retired, former commandant, assistant commandant of the Marine Corps. But you know what? Just a normal, exceedingly normal, in spite of being smart and tough. So my thanks to him for coming on and doing that. And he's, you know, a lot of living, you know, he's one of those guys who constantly seem to find their way into whatever was going on. But yeah, you know, he's, and you read his story, he had a lot of opportunities, especially as a young guy, to get derailed, and he had an inner strength in him, and very interesting guy. And then like he was talking about, the whole CENTCOM thing, that was CENTCOM before CENTCOM was cool. You know, now, you know, we take it for granted the 24/7 news cycle. We take, you know, they were doing it for the first time, and he became the face of the operations briefing for Operation Desert Storm. So, became a rock star. Yeah, you know, and there's so many leadership lessons in the book. But he comes home, he throws out the first pitch of a Red Sox game. He conducts the Boston Symphony on July 4th. Yeah, how about that? Cool stuff. And then he got to speak at his high school in Hull. So, my thanks to him for coming on. If you joined us late, don't touch that dial. We're going to talk about what's going on in Gaza, the choreography of all of that. Talk about Navy discipline. And so talk about that a little bit. And also on Iwo Jima, getting ready to develop more powerful than off-the-shelf right now ground-penetrating radar in an effort to recover the remains of the Japanese soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines, naval infantry, that still remain on the island, which is going to be no small feat because of the ordnance that lies on the island as well. So, so talk about that as well. Anyway, have a great day. We will talk to you tomorrow on a Tuesday, All Marine Radio, out.